Welcome to this 25th and final edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the 11th chapter, part 3, titled Becoming Human in the Cosmos. In considering the comparison of self-expression versus the expression of creation, I like this quote from Albert Einstein. The true value of a human being is determined primarily by the measure and the sense in which he has attained liberation from the self. End quote. That's quoted in Eben Alexander's book, Proof of Heaven, Kindle Location 1042. Perhaps these moments are facilitated by what? The Greek concept of the muse, guardian angels? The Spirit of God showing us our potentials and capacities? Unfortunately, or maybe for our own good, fortunately, it isn't something we can turn on like a light switch. I've often thought I had to hunt my muse down, bring it out of some seedy neighborhood bar in the spirit realms, sober it up as best I could, and drag it, kicking and protesting, into my writing room, where it slouches on the floor, sulking and refusing to talk to me. I guess it's good that these things aren't formulaic, cut and dried. The creative process itself needs to be creative, though there are some basic things that help. As the artist mentioned in the previous podcast might agree, being a creator sometimes means becoming the servant of the creation. Lewis Thomas has an interesting take on this two-brain creative process. From A Long Line of Cells, page 343. Quote, there is no delusion more damaging than to get the idea in your head that you understand the functioning of your own brain. Once you acquire such a notion, you run the danger of moving in to take charge, guiding your thoughts, controlling it. The human mind is not meant to be governed. It is supposed to run itself, and we are obliged to follow it along, trying to keep up with it as best we can. Never try to operate it. You are not up to the job. End quote. If, after all, as seems to be true, we are endowed with unconscious minds in our brains, those should be regarded as normal structures, installed wherever they are for a purpose. I am not sure what they are built to contain, but as a biologist impressed by the usefulness of everything alive, I would take it for granted that they are useful, probably indispensable organs of thought. It cannot be a bad thing to own one, but I would no more think of meddling with it than trying to exorcise my liver, an equally mysterious apparatus. Until we know a lot more, it would be wise, as we have learned from other fields in medicine, to let them be. Above all, not to interfere. That's A Long Line of Cells, previously quoted. It would be interesting to see Lewis Thomas and Carl Jung get together and have a conversation about the subconscious. One of God's titles is Creator. If we, as undeveloped humans, strive for that title, I think we can anticipate some connection with powers and forces that are way beyond us, and they will knock us on our butts if we're not careful, or if we're lucky. In Hugh Nibley's The Ancient State, previously cited, he writes, quote, the moments of genuine creativity are simply not within human control. Even when they create by inspiration, however, humans know that the result is but a poor reflection of the divine original. The greater the artist, in fact, the more frustrated he feels. Creation is not of this world, a place of imitation at best. The heavenly originals are no mere human ideas, but as far as we are aware of them, things actually remembered from another world. For Plato, what we recognized here as good, true, and beautiful is but a dim recollection of what we once saw in another and better world. That is Plato's doctrine of anamnesis, Plato's cave, in other words. pages 324 through 325. This idea was expressed in the allegory of Plato's cave, that is, the artist's challenge to bring back to this world what we lost in our journey from former realms, and to renew and fill our longing for better times and places. And with that in mind, let us take a look through the catalog of modern art exhibits and see how many different ways the penis, for example, can be exhibited. I've heard of, I would never go to and see one of these pathetic art shows, I have heard, however, of penis exhibits in papier-mâché, ceramic, wood, stone, Lord knows what else. This is originality. What do these artists do? Sit around their lofts thinking, well, so-and-so did a penis exhibit in clay, and what's-his-name did one in macrame. I know, I'll do one in pasta. That will be original. Historian Paul Johnson, in Art, A New History, calls the divergence of art, as we know the classics of Renoir and Matisse, into the, well, I'm just going to call it crap, that currently passes as modern art, as a descent from fine art to fashion art. Fine art lasts. Wouldn't any of us love to have the Mona Lisa hanging on our wall, and not just for the price tag? Fashion art changes, as do clothing fashions. One may have the latest fashion hanging on their wall, but a year later it will be out of date and will only be laughed at. And this after you've paid $80,000 for it. The 29th chapter of this most informative and inspiring book deals with the fall of art as we have seen it in the last century. I'll just skip quote through these pages, 651 through 683. Quote, changes in art are forced through not by the quest for order, but simply by the desire for novelty, itself enhanced by the needs of commerce. Then art becomes a fashion industry rather than a noble pursuit. Fine art becomes fashion art when the ratio of novelty and skill is changed radically in favor of novelty. These movements, though they were rich in verbal justifications, were poor in providing images that stuck in the mind. Few wanted to look at their pictures twice, the central and abiding weakness of fashion art. One of the main differences between fashion art and fine art is that the latter, if it is good, tends to last, both in time and in the viewer's attention. He is glad to return to it repeatedly. End quote. I mentioned I have my father's paintings hanging in my office. One is an ocean scene with some tacky boats tied to a wooden dock. The sea is rippled, as are the reflections of the boats and their masts. The horizon is invisible, as the sky and the sea are the same colors. I grew up in Oregon with its magnificent coast and beach and harbor scenes. I've seen days like this at the beach, and this picture brings back many fond memories. I can almost smell the salt water and hear the gulls. And as Johnson describes, I've returned to it repeatedly. No fashion art could ever do that for me. Johnson, previously quoted, concludes, quote, next came dustbin art, in which the contents of waste paper baskets were emptied into glass or plastic containers, which became exhibits. But experimental artists in the second half of the 20th century, anxious to create novelties and attract attention, that virtually everything they could think of had been done before, and usually more ingeniously, in the 1920s, once fashion art is preferred to fine art, the same essential limitations apply and repetition is inevitable. End quote. Page 719. Like the penis exhibits referred to above. The human spirit craves beauty. Today's artists aren't supplying that. They might say that what they depict is truth, but as the philosophers have observed, is not truth beauty? At least as well as ugliness. Murray, in Human Accomplishment, previously cited, pages 465, has the same optimism regarding art. Quote, great art, requires a source of inspiration that the people who produce those entertainments are not tapping. But what has been true for the last few decades need not be true perpetually. Gloomy prognoses sell short the regenerating power of certain truths. The first of these truths is that the hold of great art on the human imagination is so binding that the present intellectual nihilism cannot survive. Not too many years from now, it seems safe to predict, people who love literature, music, and painting for their power to express beauty, truth, and the good will once again dominate the faculties of the world's leading universities and set the tone for public conversation about artistic excellence. It is bizarre that people who do not love literature, music, or painting for their transcendental power came to have any sort of influential role at all. Signs that they are already coming to an end can be discerned. When the change is complete, children with the potential to create great art will once again grow up having worthy conceptions of what great means. End quote. Steven Pinker observes in The New Humanists, quote, "In the 20th century, modernism and postmodernism took over, and their practitioners disdained beauty as bourgeois, saccharine, lightweight. Art was deliberately made incomprehensible or ugly or shocking, again on the assumption that our predilections for attractive faces, landscapes, colors, and so on, were reversible social constructions. Art became baffling and uninterpretable. The elite arts wrote off the vast majority of their audience, the people who approach art in part for pleasure and edification rather than social one-upmanship." Pages 48 through 49. He goes on to observe a favorable trend now, quote, "There are movements in the arts to reintroduce beauty and narrative and melody and other basic human pleasures, and those artists are considered radical." Previously quoted. Let's hear it for the radical artists. "Curiously, money isn't the answer to creativity, though it might be a deterrent. Again, in Murray's book, we learn how Spain, during the late Renaissance, had the means, one would think, to become a major producer of great works of art born from leisure and wealth. With their American colonies, the Spanish brought in 200 tons of gold and 18,000 tons of silver. Quote, but instead, it was frittered away on war and luxury. Worse than merely wasted, Spain's temporary riches also inculcated in her people a reluctance to work that spread from the rich through the formerly industrious working class. Spain used its treasures to invigorate other European nations while losing its own momentum. Windfall wealth didn't necessarily help Spain when it was pouring in, but it hurt Spain in the long run. Spain was like an heir endowed by the accident of an eccentric will, and was debilitated in the ways that great fortunes often debilitate unprepared others." End quote. Pages 337 through 338. Like the lottery winners, losers mentioned in the previous chapter. It seems, on the other hand, that war and turmoil don't deter great art, though I certainly don't recommend them as facilitators. Quote, "The first and most famous golden age of them all, in Athens, took place against a backdrop of civil and military strife. Nowhere was disruption of daily life greater than in Athens itself, ravaged by both war and a plague in 430 BC that killed a third of the population. And yet this century and a half of war and devastation embraces the Periclean Age. Think Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, the playwrights, the sculptors. Florence, Italy, home of the Renaissance, was in a chronic state of civil strife, invasion, or threat of invasion during its greatest years." Murray previously quoted, page 332. Why this emphasis on creativity and not the how-to, but rather the foundation, the milieu? In the words of Eric Hoffer, The Ordeal of Change, page 118 through 119, quote, "The fantastic quality of human nature is partly the product of man's unfinishedness. Being without specialized organs, man is in a sense a half animal. He has to finish himself by technology, and in doing so, he is a creator, in a sense a half-god. Again, lacking organic adaptations to a particular environment, he must adapt the environment to himself and recreate the world. The never-ending task of finishing himself, of transcending the limits of his physical being, is the powerhouse of man's creativeness and the source of his unnaturalness. For it is in the process of finishing himself that man sloughs off the fixity and boundless submissiveness of nature." End quote. And we needn't stress if, by the end of our lives, we haven't finished all we thought we could do. Victor Hugo, famous French writer, wrote, quote, "I feel I have not said the thousandth part of what is in me. When I go down to the grave, I can say, like many others, I have finished my day's work. But I cannot say I have finished my life's work. My day's work will begin again the next morning. The tomb is not a blind alley. It is an open thoroughfare. It closes on the twilight. It opens on the dawn. My work is only beginning." I'm not sure of the origin of this quote. It comes from Tad Callister's book, The Infinite Atonement, page 241. I like the way Stephen Hawking finishes his classic book, A Brief History of Time. In a discussion on the physicist's search for a theory of everything, Hawking writes, quote, "However, if we do discover a complete theory, it should in time be understandable in broad principle by everyone, not just a few scientists. Then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, be able to take part in the discussion of the question of why it is that we and the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we should know the mind of God." End quote. Page 175. We must see the cosmos opening up to us. We must see a virtually infinite road in front of us, yet a road well worth traveling, well marked, with many conveniences, rewards, rest stops, and dramatic views along the way, and with guidebooks and tour directors aplenty. Travel on, my brothers and sisters, travel on. To stay where you are is to sit by the side of this great road, just watching as others proceed up it and get lost from view beyond us. The Teaching Company has a lecture series by Professor Daniel N. Robinson of Oxford and Georgetown Universities titled The Great Ideas of Philosophy. In a summing up of the series, Robinson examines four theories of the good life in order to come to some kind of conclusion as to what it is that makes for a life well lived. In this, he examines, for instance, the life of Mother Teresa, the famed Catholic sister who worked with the lepers in India. Hers, indeed, was a truly good life, well lived. But the reality is the great majority of us will never be a Mother Teresa. Then he relates the story of Cleopas and Bito. These were two Greek boys, and their story is this. Their mother wanted to go to the temple of Hera and worship, but the servants had neglected to yoke the oxen to her cart, and that delay threatened to make her late. Cleopas and Bito were good sons, the kind that any parent would love to have and would be a credit to their family. They harnessed themselves in place of the oxen and pulled their mother 5 miles to the temple. While she's in there, they take a nap in the shade under the wagon to restore their energy from the long, hard pull up the hill. Mom, grateful and impressed at the love and sacrifice shown by her sons, prays to Hera that her boys may die the happiest of men. When she emerges from the temple, she finds that her boys have died in their sleep. Well, that's a nasty surprise, we all think. Be careful what you pray for, you just might get it. But the point that Herodotus, the Greek historian, makes in telling this is that we can't really say who is happy until pretty much at the end. We might be happy now, but the next moment can bring tragedy. Happiness isn't so much our feelings right now, but rather the accumulation of a life well lived. And what is the life well lived? Robinson refers to Cleopas and Bito's sacrifice for their mother in these terms, quote, "What we should aspire to is what Cleopas and Bito attained, which is the admiration of good people and an admiration based on virtuous conduct, not celebrity per se, not really heroism per se. There is something fundamentally decent about it." And more to the point, it tells us something about the kind of men they were. The Great Ideas of Philosophy, Lecture Transcript, Part 1, page 5, or page 90, rather, from The Teaching Company. Very few of us will win the Congressional Medal of Honor, few a Nobel Prize, but will the accumulation of our life's work be a work of small examples of sacrifice, love, and thoughtfulness for others? If the accomplishments of our lives could be put on the proverbial scale of 1 to 10, 1 being something like pulling a cactus thorn out of a dog's paw, and 10 being discovering a cure for cancer, how many of us will get a 10? I've personally given up hoping of scoring a 10 on some action or discovery. I've found that life offers me numerous opportunities to score a 1, and several of these over a lifetime add up to a 10. The world will never note my accumulations of 1s. That's okay. God also keeps score, as does my subconscious spirit, which will report to God at my life's review with Him. The title of this last chapter is Becoming Human in the Cosmos, as is the title of this book. I didn't want it to be a how-to manual, but rather a putting into perspective and context the major problems we face and must deal with. Seeing adversity and trials as our best teachers was dealt with in the previous chapter. Loving ourselves and from that love, loving others, Betty Eady writes, "We were to be tested under challenging conditions to see how we would live the most important commandment of all, to love one another. We are all collectively bonded to each other while on earth, united in this one supreme purpose, to learn to love one another." Page 97, previously cited. Forgiving, living in love with our enemies, the eternal quest for knowledge, our relationship to the natural world and the life that shares this planet and the cosmos with us, the importance of creativity and the milieu in which it happens, and the essence of just what makes for the good life. Of those, just two are consistently mentioned by near-death experiencers: learning to love and learning. God doesn't expect us to come back perfect, just committed to that direction. As Paul said once again, go on unto perfection. Let's express our entire lives here on a bumper sticker couplet, okay? Learn to love, love to learn. That's it. In the introduction, I said God is just science we don't know, coupled with an overwhelming love for His children. As Ralph Waldo Emerson said, The Story of Philosophy, previously cited, Will Durant, page Roman numeral 28, quote, "Do you know the secret of the true scholar? In every man there is something wherein I may learn of him, and in that I am his pupil," end quote. Raymond Moody's book, The Light Beyond, expresses it thus, quote, "All of the people who go through this, the near-death experience, come away believing that the most important thing in their life is love. For most of them, the second most important thing in life is knowledge. As they see life scenes in which they are learning things, the being points out that one of the things they can take with them at death is knowledge. The other is love." Pages 14 through 15. Alexander, previously cited, writes powerfully on this most important aspect of our spiritual development. Quote, "How do we get closer to the genuine spiritual self? By manifesting love and compassion. Why? Because love and compassion are far more than the abstractions many of us believe them to be. They are real. They are concrete. And they make up the very fabric of the spiritual realm. In order to return to that realm, we must once again become like that realm, even while we are stuck in and plodding through this one." Kindle location 1160. I note as my Kindle lists the number of highlighters that have emphasized a passage, as read by others, that this particular passage has, as of this date's count, 2012, 1,213 highlighters. Must be it strikes a resonant chord in readers of this most amazing near-death experience book. I know it does with me. Learning to love and loving to learn will put us on that path that will, after eons to be sure, bring us to a true oneness with God, and will fully qualify us to open that branch office of Salvation Incorporated, should we be so inclined. If I may draw near to the close of this book and this podcast with the opening of Betty Eady's book, Embraced by the Light, previously cited, page Roman numeral 9, quote, "Love is supreme. Love must govern. We are sent here to live life fully, to live it abundantly, to find joy in our own creations, to experience both failure and success, to use free will to expand and magnify our lives. We are to love one another. We are to be kind, to be tolerant, to give generous service." And now, to close. I'm somewhat of a neat freak, though to see me you'd never know. Favorite dress, blue jeans and t-shirt. Anything else is painful. But I do like order, and part of that sense of order for me is a closure that goes back to the beginning and it makes a neatly wrapped package of the whole. Bookends, if you will. I started with a quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn in Chapter 1. I shall finish with another quote from this man who, as I mentioned, I consider to be the greatest writer and thinker of the 20th century. Let me give the context from Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, pages 547 through 549. In a rail car while being transported to a camp, Solzhenitsyn and other political prisoners encounter the ubiquitous thieves. They were all mixed in with the political prisoners and plundered and abused them without restraint. The thieves' apprentices, 12-year-old boys, took the food from the political prisoners as they lay on the floor of the rail car under the bunks, the only place left to settle in. Solzhenitsyn writes, "It took no more than a minute for them to seize the bundles with the fat bacon, sugar, and bread. They were gone. We lay there feeling stupid. We had given up our food without a fight." Solzhenitsyn had been a captain in the Red Army and had faced fire from the Germans in World War II. He asks, "Am I a coward? I had thought I wasn't one. The Germans were one thing. These thieves were another. Among other problems, he couldn't be sure his back would be covered by his fellow victims, and the thieves held a special places in the hearts of the prison guards and the Soviet communist system. The political prisoners had no friends except maybe each other, and that was highly suspect." Solzhenitsyn faces the ringleader of the thieves to demand some kind of compensation for his stolen goods. Quote, "But now, plundered and humiliated, I found it offensive to get down flat on my stomach again and crawl back beneath the bunks. And so I addressed the ringleader of the thieves indignantly and told him that since he had taken our food away from us, he might, well, at least give us a place on the bunks." The ringleader of the thieves agreed. After all, I was thereby surrendering any claim to the fat bacon, and I was thereby recognizing his superior authority, and I was revealing a point of view in common with his. He, too, would have driven off the weakest. end quote. Solzhenitsyn gets his wish. Two of his fellow political prisoners are forced out of their bunks and to the floor from which Solzhenitsyn had so recently come. This increased comfort is not to be enjoyed. At night, he hears the whispers of his brother politicals condemning him for consorting with the thieves in treating them shabbily. Quote, "And only then did awareness of my own meanness prick my conscience and make me blush. And for many years thereafter, I blushed every time I remembered it. They hadn't done me any harm, and I had them." He concludes, as I do, with this observation, quote, "And thus it is that we have to keep getting banged on flank and snout again and again, so as to become, in time at least, human beings." Yes, human beings. End quote. Epilogue. Sir Francis Bacon, quote, "And being now at some pause, looking back into that I have passed through, this writing seemeth to me, as far as man can judge of his own work, not much better than that noise or sound which musicians make while they are tuning their instruments, which is nothing pleasant to hear, but yet is a cause why the music is sweeter afterwards. So have I been content to tune the instruments of the muses that they may play that have better hands," end quote. As quoted in The Age of Reason Begins, Will and Ariel Durant, page 181. And now for the bibliography. I'm not going to read the title of every book I've quoted. There are 158 sources. That would just be boring. So what I will do, I'm kind of a numbers trivia nut in a way. I will go through some of the numbers trivia, as it were, in this bibliography. Hopefully you will enjoy this as well. As I mentioned, 158 sources, 754 quotes as of November 2018. The topics are divided thus: Scripture and Apocrypha, Wisdom and Philosophy, Near Death and Near Death Commentary, Science, Physics and Astronomy, Science, Biology, New Age, and Other Sources. In Scripture and Apocrypha, we have the most quotes coming from the Bible, the New Testament, 61 quotes, Bible, Old Testament, 33 quotes. As far as LDS scriptures, the Book of Mormon, 3 quotes, the Doctrine and Covenants, 2 quotes, and the Pearl of Great Price, 2 quotes. Under Wisdom and Philosophy, Ralph Waldo Emerson takes first place. The writings of Ralph Waldo Emerson, 10 quotes. Well, I was wrong on that. Carl Jung takes first place. Modern Man in Search of a Soul, 15 quotes. Hugh Nibley, from his collected works, takes the most cumulatively, 16 quotes from Old Testament and Related Studies. Nibley, on the Timely and the Timeless, 11 quotes. In Science, Biology, Stephen Gould is quoted from 7 different sources. Most quotes come from Wonderful Life, 4 quotes. New Age, Michael Newton is quoted the most. Destiny of Souls, 8. Journey of Souls, 7. And thus we conclude this 25th and final podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. Thanks for tuning in. And special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com. That's hazelleproductions.com. And if you have actually stayed through all 25 of these podcasts, my hat is off to you. Thank you very much indeed.